Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Webster Topley. Webster is an author, he's a journalist, a lecturer. He's a very outspoken critic of U.S. foreign and domestic policy. That pretty much goes for most of the people we have on this program, and I say most. Well, I really should say all. I was really thinking of people who come on, economists or financial experts who come on to talk about those issues. Webster is very qualified on that score as well. He does an awful lot on geopolitical interest, but he certainly writes about economic and financial ones. His most recent book that I'm familiar with gets into that, about the devastation that followed the 2007 crisis. But it sure didn't begin then. It began long before then. So much that we can talk about. And let me just make a few comments. I can't stop dwelling on these things myself. Webster does it all the time. We really have a critical situation that too few people understand, whether we're talking about permanent wars, one literally morphing into another, and then they go on in multiples. They're going on in multiples now. They're not one. They're just fought. They're fought because they're so damn profitable to keep fighting them. So Afghanistan is a war profiteer's dream, just the way Vietnam was. You know, the wars that doesn't end. It just goes on and on. The weapons that are used up and the munitions, they have to be replaced. The Lockheed Martins and all the others, many others, the small guys with the big ones, they love it. They absolutely love it. They have lobbyists that promote war. Well, I mean, the politicians in Washington do a good job of that by themselves. And then we have all the rest that's going on, the economic devastation that seems to go from bad to worse. And literally, we're heading for a cataclysm because the policies are literally so destructive. Nothing is done to relieve what easily could be if politicians did what they know, what they have experts who know what to do, but they don't do it. And we talk about those things on this program too. And somewhere down the road, there is just an unbelievable cataclysm coming. Who knows when? Takes my breath away. I say often, and I write it, my heart goes out to young people today. Most of them have no future to look forward to. It wasn't that way when I was growing up. Webster, welcome to the program. I'll let you jump into any issue that really is on your mind most.
Thank you, Steve. I would just first of all say you are much too pessimistic, and this apocalyptic stuff has now been done to death. And the issue, of course, is there is a world crisis. There is a world depression. There are all these dangers you talk about. What are we going to do about it? What's the organizing perspective? And I find it important to deal less and less with analysis or muckraking, right? There are all kinds of people who do this, right? Left liberals will do that. Even certain libertarians can do some of it.
I'm not a muckraker, Webster. I honestly try to tell it the way I see it.
But again, what people need are answers. They need an organizing perspective. They need marching orders. They need an idea of what to do.
Okay, believe me, I am all ears. I'm sure everybody is all ears.
Good. What I think right now is the thing that I would put forward is because of the void that has opened up in the sort of radical or anti-establishment politics. We've had two interesting things happen. One is that the fraud of Ron Paul, Rand Paul, this entire con job that the two of them did to try to get little Rand installed in power as Vice President of the United States on a Romney-Rand Paul ticket, that has collapsed at least as far as the radical base of that, I think. This is now widely discredited, although you have small troops of fanatics that continue to push ahead with the Ron Paul stuff. And I would stress, this is not just the idea that Ron Paul is a scoundrel, that Rand Paul is a scoundrel, or that they have fascist policies, because they do. But the issue is libertarianism itself. In other words, the whole mindset of the Austrian school, von Hayek and von Mises, these people were paid, both of them, by David Rockefeller. It's a synthetic ideology. So now we see Ron Paul acting that out. And the whole purpose of this campaign was to do service to Romney, as working as his right wing man, and then to get a little Rand, if not the vice presidency, then something big, maybe Secretary of the Treasury or I don't know what. But I think primarily Little Rand thinks he should be president on the basis of no qualifications. That is stupid frat boy from Baylor University mouthing these idiotic things. He, by the way, Rand Paul is showing his true colors right now. He's harassing the District of Columbia. He's a racist Southern senator, and he's harassing the District of Columbia. He stopped them from having their own budget in the past couple of weeks. So there's a wave of hatred against Rand Paul here in the black community in the district, and he deserves every drop of it. So this is one side, right? This thing is collapsing. People notice this. We had this Bilderberger meeting. I got involved in some debates with different people, with Alex Jones, with Kokesh. And then within a couple of days, Rand Paul acted out pretty much what I had – it was no big prediction, but it was clear that was what he was going to do. He'd actually already done it the week before. But by endorsing Romney, this entire thing is now out in the open. So this one side. Now, if the other side, we look at the Occupy Wall Street. And here we see the nefarious role of this thing called Adbusters, which is this, what can we say? It's in the orbit of NATO intelligence. It's out there in Vancouver, British Columbia. And it's made up of anarchists. The interesting thing you see here is that counterinsurgency, extreme left and extreme right, or left and right, whatever you want to call it, the counterinsurgency is largely based on anarchism. Right-wing anarchism, left-wing anarchism. You could make a good case that Ron Paul and Rand Paul are right-wing anarchists, and then we have the left-wing anarchists or situationist anarchists of the Adbusters Foundation, and above all, an anthropologist operating out of Yale and London called David Graeber. He is the gravedigger of Occupy Wall Street because he's the godfather, along with this foundation, of this idea you can't have any demands, you can't have majority rule, you've got to have endless discussions where political correctness is important, where nobody's feelings can be hurt by polemics, everybody's got to be respected, even the craziest people. You've got to have, 80% or 90% so you can have a small minority really doing filibuster and stopping the entire group. So this guaranteed the impotence under facilitators who distinguished themselves also for racism, right? You probably saw that scene where Congressman John Lewis wanted to come and support the Occupy Wall Street in Atlanta, Georgia, and they wouldn't let him in. And there's this character in the leadership of Adbusters, this Kali Lawson, who seems to be the godfather of that wing of it, right? That he's got some kind of racial trip going on or some kind of a doctrine of that sort. Remains to be seen. Anyway, when you see Bill Maher, the comedian, do a mockery, and I think a very good one, a satire of Occupy Wall Street as a bunch of kids who want to camp in the park. They're happy campers, unhappy campers, but they have added up to nothing. Again, you can compare them to the Tea Party. The Tea Party got what? Hey, the Tea Party got 75 members of Congress, half a dozen senators, based on their agitation in 2009 into 2010. What is the Occupy Wall Street headed for? Well, the answer is zero, nothing, absolute zip, nada, because of this anarchism, right, that they say, oh, we can't have demands because then we might be co-opted by the system. I don't know. You're left, scratching your head in wonderment, right, that people can be so gullible.
What I'm scratching my head about is at the beginning of the program, after my little monologue, you said, you're so pessimistic. Well, I will repeat to you. You are so pessimistic. I must
Yeah, but wait. But this is the truth. Now, what this has done is, here's the optimistic part. Because of the collapse of Ron Paul, Rand Paul, and because of the widespread discrediting of these stupid anarchists who are wreckers, right? They're agents, right? They're there to wreck. That's what they get paid to do. They're foundation operatives. There's now this void. There's a void right in the middle of the whole anti-establishment scene. And this doesn't happen often. Actually, the last time it happened was as the peace movement was collapsing in 2007, because of the coming of the Obama machine, and the Allied Foundations were sucking the money out of the peace movement. So the peace movement, all the peace movement fakers, right, the various left liberal peacenik types, they were going down, right? They had been cut off at the knees by the foundations. And the Obama fraud had only begun to start, right? The Obama stuff, of course, got going really in January of 2008 with the primary. So there was the whole second half of 2007, there was a similar void. And that was a time when some of us tried to do something about that by having this Philadelphia anti-war conference on July 4th, 2007 in Independence Mall. We had 200 or 300 people coming together, and unfortunately it didn't gel because of the mobilization of countervailing forces. But now you have such a situation again. I think it's important for you to see this, right? Plus any residual belief in Obama, I think, has also been pretty much eroded, right? That's pretty much gone. So Obama's out of the picture. The Occupy Wall Street is discredited. Ron Paul and Rand Paul are nepotists and con artists. So now there's a void, and I think it's important to finally say to people, look, you left-wing anarchists over there, you have wrecked Occupy Wall Street. This doctrine is crazy. You need solid New Deal demands, class-based demands, that have to do with the fact that families are fighting for existence. They don't need to have new culture jamming and detournement or whatever they call these things, right? They don't need that. They need to stop somebody from foreclosing on their house. They need to pay their kids' tuition bill. They need to buy the groceries. They need to get to a doctor, right? They need these very, very concrete things. Not process reforms, not campaign finance reform, or, you know, let's have a new I don't know what, some distant reform. Even Glass-Steagall, right? The Glass-Steagall proposal is a fine proposal, but that's no agitational demand. Anybody who thinks that's an agitational demand is crazy. What does Joe Sixpack care about Glass-Steagall? Eventually, it would be important. But right now, it's got to be something more like no cuts to unemployment benefits, or 99 weeks plus, right? Indefinite, unlimited unemployment benefits. The other side is Ron Paul and Rand Paul. And both of them are union busters, right? Both of them support a national right-to-work law. Well, there they are following in the footsteps of Hitler and Mussolini, because that is the first thing that both Hitler and Mussolini did, was to smash every union in sight. And in their cases, they replaced them with fascist unions. But in the case of Ron Paul and Rand Paul, they don't want to replace them with anything. They want everybody to be completely atomized. And this is a real important contradiction, because if you say, I'm against totalitarianism, but at the same time, I want to smash the only mass-based organizations that would have any hope of fighting a coup, let's say, or mounting some kind of a mass protest, and they've done it even in recent years, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. The other thing, Ron Paul created, I think, a big problem for himself by actually publishing his budget, because on the stump, Ron Paul can tap dance with the best of them, right? He's one of the most successful con artists, which is why he has this idea that he's incorruptible, right? There are so many suckers who believe that. But in reality, you look at his budget, right? It's called Restore America. And here's what he has. On the one side, he claims that he's going to be the draconian cutter of the defense budget. Well, no, he's not. His own statistics, go to his website and look at Restore America. He wants to cut the permanent structural Pentagon budget by 15%. That is no cut. He's not adding anything. That is what's already happening. Obama has already cut the defense budget by about 8%, and then, assuming that the automatic sequestration occurs at the end of the year, right, because of the failure of the 12 tyrants to come up with an austerity plan, there's now going to be the series of automatic cuts. That will cut about 7 to 8% out of the Pentagon. So there it is. Ron Paul's 15% cut in the Pentagon adds zero to the cuts that are already in the pipeline. There's nothing added. But what he does do, let's just take food stamps. It's the most extreme example. We have 50 million people in this country who are on the verge of, I think, terrible, tragic consequences. It's 50 million people who were left in the lurch, first of all, by Clinton when he abolished welfare, right? The aid for mothers with dependent children under the Social Security Act of 1935. That was what Clinton did. He abolished that in a deal with Gingrich in order to get himself reelected in 1996. So there's no more welfare. These people have no jobs. The unemployment benefits went, in some cases, up to 99 weeks, but they're way beyond that. In most cases, they never got anywhere near 99 weeks because they're in these, you know, southern states, reactionary states, or states that have cut the budget in other ways. So there's no job, no unemployment benefits. There's no health care, right? This is exactly the 50 million people who can't get to the doctor. What they live on is food stamps, and food stamps is about $31 a week in most metropolitan areas. So that means you're at about $1.50, $1.60 per person per meal. Ron Paul says that's communism, of course, right? That's no good. That violates the Austrian school and the free market, so people are going to have to face the consequences. And he wants to cut it by 63%, almost two-thirds cut in food stamps. So the Pentagon gets cut 15% on paper, but really nothing, whereas the food stamps get cut 63%. And we'll then be down to a level of about 50 to 55 cents per meal, per person per meal. Now, what does that mean? Well, it has names. Vitamin deficiency diseases that most people have never heard of anymore because they've been largely, or had been, in certain areas at least, wiped out. Scurvy, pellagra, rickets. These are horrible diseases. But if you have a diet, you know, straight diet of beans, only beans or only spaghetti or whatever it is, that's where you're headed. If there's no citrus, there's no fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, and you can't afford those with 55 cents per person per meal. So my word on Ron Paul is he wants genocide for the American people. Genocide.
Let me jump in a little bit. I must say that just about everything you're talking about, I've written about, and I agree that these people are up to no good. I wrote a very long article on Ron Paul. I mean, he made it easy. His website, it's been over a year since I've done it, and I don't have it in front of me, but his website listed all the things he wanted to do. You just have to go there and see the ravaging that he wants to do to ordinary people.
Right,
as far as
exactly.
Cutting the Pentagon budget goes, I don't think there'll be much of any cut at all, and they'll cut things like they'll make the returning servicemen who have their brains blown out or their limbs blown off, they'll make them pay more for their health care if they get anything at all. They'll cut whatever education benefits the few of them might have gotten. They'll just slash and burn what the ordinary troops will get, and if the Pentagon wants another this, that, or something else, they're going to get it. Plus all the black budgets that we don't know how many billions or tens of billions or hundreds of billions go into those damn things. And the same beat goes on all the time. And I must say that the Democrats and Obama are the same kind of human wreckers as the Republicans. Is a bipartisan conspiracy to literally ravage America. And I agree with economist Paul Craig Roberts, who was on this program Thursday.
Wait a minute. That, now you're back with Ron Paul, because that's who he supports.
Paul Craig. Oh, did I say Ron Paul? Paul Craig Roberts.
Yeah, he's a Ron Paul man. He's 1,000% Paul.
No, we didn't talk about Ron Paul, but he called America a third world country, and what hasn't been accomplished so far, we are on a fast track to accomplishing it on the backs of the people who can least afford it.
Let me just whisper one second. He should tell us what he did in the Reagan administration to make this all possible, because that's who he is. I am sick and tired of these reactionary Republicans. They say, oh, now I'm not a reactionary Republican anymore. Now I'm a libertarian, and now I have a new political virginity. I'm reborn, and now I can pretend that I didn't do the things that I did do. This character is a dyed-in-the-wool Ron Paul supporter. And again, I don't need new zingers to tell me these things, right? I need an organizing perspective, and maybe we could turn to that in a second when you're done.
Oh, I mean, I could go on and on, and we're just talking about domestic stuff. I sure want to spend some time on what's going on overseas, but I'm very concerned about what's happening. I know you are as well, Webster, and I mean, the truth of the matter, whatever things we could disagree on around the edges, I think we both agree very strongly that we really have corrupt politicians that are really running the country for their own benefit and the corporate profiteers that fund them.
Something to do about it. Everybody knows this. This has now been done to death. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I have my solution. I think the system is too broken to fix, and literally what we need is a damn revolution to rip the whole thing down to the ground and start over again, because I don't think anything else can work. I honestly believe that nothing else will work, and unless people revolt, I'll say about America what I said a couple of times in articles about the Greek people in Greece. They have three choices. They literally have three choices. They can either starve, they can leave, or they can rebel. I don't see any other choice, and I would say that those are the same choices for Americans. Choose one of them. You may not be starving today, but the way the politicians are running things, they're heading for it, and there are two new code words, Webster, I'm sure you know these, that will replace austerity. I think they already have, but they certainly will post-November. Instead of talking about austerity now, we'll talk about the grand bargain, the conspiracy
Right.
between the Republicans and the Democrats, and the fiscal cliff. The fiscal
good.
Cliff.
Very good. Excellent. Those are the ones. That's all coming in December. The lame duck session of Congress, right? And I think we also have to, there's a third one, and it's called Romney, because there is a difference. Here's the difference. Obama is the slow death of a thousand cuts. It's a dose of poison every day, and you get weaker and weaker over time. The ruling class says, that was fine, that's not good enough anymore. That was okay to get us through 2008, 2009, when there was the danger of a collapse of the entire thing. And if there had been some kind of mass resistance, then it would have gone down, at least in the current form. So they say, that's not good enough. We want the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We want everybody flayed alive, carved limb from limb within 30 seconds. And that will be Romney, and I'll explain how Romney will do it, because Romney is now the ruling class candidate. But let's get the organizing perspective on the table. There is this thing coming up, right, in December, right? What you say, the fiscal cliff and the grand bargain will be a giant step in the direction of Ron Paul's program. In other words, Ron Paul has been the point man for fascist austerity and genocide against the American people now in his entire campaign. He has made fascist economics presentable. In other words, if you say there are 50 million Americans living in extreme poverty and food stamps are their only means of survival, and Ron Paul comes along and says, I'm cutting that by 63%, the answer to that would normally be Nazi go home, right? That would have been the 50s, the 60s, maybe into the 70s. But now it's the freedom agenda, right? So people have been pretty thoroughly duped. Here's what I would say. Given the fact that this Adbusters thing, I think, is widely discredited, the Ron Paul, Rand Paul equally in trouble, there's now a chance to organize something, and I would call it, and I'd be interested to see what you think, something like the Emergency National Anti-Austerity Committee. Emergency National Anti-Austerity Committee. I had originally thought about this as an Emergency National Anti-Austerity Conference, but I think that might put the emphasis too much on a simple event, and I found that the experience of 5 years ago indicates that if you focus it all on a conference, once the conference is over, you may be left with less continuity than you're going to need. But somehow, I would urge you to be a part of this, we've got to find a way to have some kind of continuing collaboration in programmatic terms and in agitational terms, right? Or better yet, program, propaganda, and agitation to try to create an alternative. And what I mean by the alternative is this. You have a lot of these so-called centrists, right? They say that the theoretical point of a national majority is somewhere between the Republicans and the Democrats. This is wrong. The real center of gravity of the American people in terms of economics, and I stress economics, is significantly to the left of the Democratic Party. It's the New Deal, which is what the Democratic Party has betrayed and is trying to destroy using methods that are slightly slower than the Republican methods, but still they aim at the destruction of the New Deal. So if you ask the American people, are cuts in Social Security acceptable? 80% say no. Are cuts in Medicare acceptable? 80% say no. And there are similar majorities, lopsided, right? Maybe not quite as big, but certainly clear majorities, usually two-thirds to three-quarters, in favor of things like Medicaid, of unemployment insurance, and the other various New Deal, Great Society, New Frontier kinds of reforms. Now, that's economics. In terms of social policy, it's much different. The center is more central, I guess. It's hard to put this in these terms. But right now, I think the immediate thing is to simply focus on the economics and say that there's got to be some kind of an attempt to regroup. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't go into Democratic primaries, because I think a lot of the people that you're going to try to win over are still in the Democratic Party, or at least oriented towards voting in Democratic primaries or looking to the Democratic Party, disillusioned as they now are. There are some people coming from the Republican side, but I have to say many of these people are permanently crippled by this right-wing Yahoo ideology, right? This Austrianism, von Hayek, von Mises, this slave ideology, right? Anti-government. The mindset of these people is not mass organizing. It's, you know, these people, they regard themselves as like Robinson Crusoe individuals with their gun, with their gold, with their food stocks, with their whatever else they have, their water filters, and they're holed up in their houses, you know, waiting for the revenuers or the black helicopters to come. So this has done tremendous damage. Ron Paul has knocked out a lot of people. But leaving that aside, what I'm looking for is ways to organize this now as we go into the autumn. In other words, there's got to be a focus of activity for people, some kind of a committee, right? I would call it a committee, not so much a conference, although the committee, if it once got going, could well then decide to organize some kind of a conference. So that could also be done on the Internet, or it could be a virtual conference. It could be done in any number of ways. And then in terms of the model, though, when you say revolution, right? It sounds like the apocalypse, right? It's very abstract. I would say, look at Greece, right? I think the most successful model of the past 2 years is Syriza in Greece, and this is the party of Alexis Tsipras. And we look at Ron Paul, Rand Paul, that's a failure. Look at Adbusters, they're a failure. But Tsipras has gone from a party with 4%. To a party with 27%. He's gone from way back in the pack to being the second largest party in the country, and he came rather close to actually winning the election, in which case he would have gotten a 50-seat bonus in the parliament. What was the secret of that success? I would say four things, but especially one thing, right? The four things are program. They have a program. They have an organization. It's the Syriza bloc. It's 12 different components that have come together. And they're now welded into a single party. So these were, you know, splinter groups, some of them, right? Some of them quite small sectarian organizations. Somehow they were able to bring them together as the crisis got worse. And the crisis in Greece is more advanced, obviously, than it has been here in terms of mass misery, mass protest, and so forth. They have a trade union movement, but that was crippled because it was tied to PASOK and the Papandreou people, who were, of course, IMF and CIA and Soros agents. The third thing they have is a strategy, which is don't join an austerity coalition, right? Don't compromise yourself by becoming a tool of the IMF. And they have a leader. They have an individual who can come forth as a spokesman. Notice all of these four things, the program, the organization, the leadership, and the strategy, those are all things that Occupy Wall Street says you shouldn't have. Those are all bad, says Adbusters and Graeber and these fakers, right? Kevin Zeese here in Washington, D.C., right? The Freedom Plaza. Those are all bad things. You should have facilitators. You should have a consensus. You should have a 90%, whatever. You should essentially, you should tie yourself up in knots discussing where the porta potties go and never have a word to say about anything important, and no important economic demand can get through, and everything's got to be politically correct. So let's just go into the program for a second, though, because I think this shows people what is necessary.
Can I make one comment?
Yeah,
we're going to have to break, and then we'll come right back. Let me just get a quick comment in, and then we'll take a break and come back. I think Syriza talks a better game than what they really have in mind. Oh, they're better than the so-called New Democracy and PASOK and the other groups. They are basically, as you say, Webster, pro-IM, pro-Troika, EU, IMF, and ECB. The same old stuff, the austerity, the socket to the ordinary people. Well, Syriza says no to austerity. I honestly don't believe them. I think if they came in, they would waffle and they would waver and they wouldn't do what they promised. But they want to stay in the euro system. And the euro
that's the correct position.
Disaster.
That is the correct position, Steve, because the U.S. and the British are destroying the euro. In other words, the crisis that you see is economic warfare by the U.S. and the British against the euro in order to save the dollar. And there's a complicated history of these things, which many people think they can simplify, but that is the correct demand. It's also anything else is off the charts in terms of actual politics. There's a stratum of crazed petty bourgeois across Europe. It's strong in Germany, where the illusions are very dense. But if you look at Europe, you show me the parties that are actually anti-euro, and you can see that this is a very, very small movement of parties of opinion. And in Greece, the only party, I think, that was, well, I don't know if any major party in Greece
was
anti-euro.
None of them were against the euro. Webster, we need to take a break. Let's do that. Hold your thought, and we'll come right back. Welcome back. On with Webster Topley, talking about a lot of things domestic, and then we got into what was going on in Greece, which really segues right from the economic financial situation in America and across Europe. It's big stuff, and all the big issues seem to come together, Webster. One ties into another. I guess the bottom line is screw the people and let the corporate types make maximum profits, and you do it whether it's by this terrible austerity stuff that gets foisted on people, whether it's a rotten Eurozone straitjacket that I've written a fair amount about, whether it's austerity in America or whatever they have planned coming under new, names, whether it's imperial wars, all the stuff ties together, and the ordinary people get hung out to dry, and the corporate profiteers get stronger and bigger, and they make more than ever money, and the politicians get their pockets lined, and it's one scandal after another. Once in a while, this stuff even makes headlines, but not too often.
I would say the point where it all comes together is the need for an emergency national anti-austerity organizing committee. And again,
can I jump in with one comment on that? I absolutely believe that the starting point of getting people mobilized to do something about protecting their own welfare is to get them informed. If people don't know what in the hell is going on, they don't understand the problem, or they know something's wrong, but they don't realize how directly it harms their personal welfare, unless they realize that and then look at themselves today and compare it to a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and let them reach their own conclusion that, by God, these guys are really screwing me, and then get them angry, and then get them wanting to do something. I don't like doing it by political means, or that's not the right term. But you're talking about an initiative that may very well have some merit, Webster. But I think the bottom line is that you can't reason with these people and what they're doing. And I'm not certain how many you can mobilize to get involved in an initiative. I want to get people mad as hell to really want to go out and do something, because they just won't take it anymore.
That sounds like that rather banal movie of 1975.
1979, I think it was. Yeah, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, you've been networking too much. Look, you've got to do mass education. That's fine, but at a certain point, when a void like that opens up, when the poll machine is in big trouble, when the Adbusters and Graber and these wreckers are equally in trouble, when Obama is receding from the people that he's duped, you've got a lot of people who need an alternative, and it's the responsibility of leadership to provide it. And yes, you do need leaders. And yes, some people will say that's top down. Let it come from wherever it comes. If it comes from the bottom, the top, or the sides, is it a valid idea, and is this the time to do it? And the problem with the approach that you've just outlined is it's like training in warfare, right? If the training goes on and on and on, somehow you're never ready to go out and actually do something. But let's make it concrete. What we're talking about right now is cadre. We're talking about, in this country, it's a stratum of, you know, it might be 10 or 20,000 people. Let's call it 30,000, right? So we're working with percentages, who might be available for the creation of a programmatic alternative. The problem is that they are still chock full of the ideology, primarily of this Occupy Wall Street, although some of them may be of the Pauls. They're infected by anarchism and any number of other prejudices that have been dished up by the foundations. There are people who believe that Noam Chomsky is an intellectual, or that Naomi Klein is worth something, or Wolf, or how many Naomis we have. So the point is, you've got to provide an alternative for those cadre, not for the massy mass, because right now the massy mass is choosing between Romney and Obama. But if you don't do it now, by the time you get to December and January and into next year, when it's either going to be the Romney chainsaw or the continued Obama death of a thousand cuts, with the Obama method speeding up, as you've pointed out, right, in December at the lame duck conference of the Congress, right, there'll be the fiscal cliff and the other things that you've mentioned will come into play, right? And the grand bargain will be enacted, and at that point, genocidal austerity will be partially implemented, right? Again, a step towards the Ron Paul. So you got to do this now, and you've got to put out the call now so that people realize that there's an alternative to dropping out and an alternative to despair or narcotics or whatever people turn to when they don't know what else to do. Now, what you said about the euro, I think this is fundamentally wrong, and I'll tell you why. The dynamic of this entire crisis is it's a paper by Christine Romer in the Obama White House. She was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors.
Yeah, I remember.
Her research was how flight capital from Europe in the 1930s, the late 1930s, flight capital from Europe propped up the U.S. and kept the U.S. from being as deeply mired in the Depression as otherwise would have been the case because of the breakdown of international trade and the autarky policies and other things. I'm just saying these things because it's not Franklin D. Roosevelt's fault. It's, if anything, it's Hitler's fault and the fault of the British that international trade had collapsed. But this is the idea of the entire Obama strategy is shift the depression from the U.S. and Britain, where it started in 07, 08, shift that into Europe. Export the depression. Beggar my neighbor. Start attacking Europe. Now, you look at Europe. How can you attack Europe when you have the euro? The euro is $1 trillion a day. You can't go directly against that. Even a large group of zombie banks and hedge fund hyenas would have a very hard time moving the needle on $1 trillion of euros being bought and sold per day. So they said, what we'll do is we'll attack the very small, limited, illiquid, narrow markets of the bonds of some of these southern European countries. And that would be Greece and Portugal and Ireland and the so-called pigs. And that is done with credit default swaps and then with synthetic credit derivatives on top of those. So with that, you can multiply the destructive power of your speculative finance. The goal is to smash the euro. In other words, the Anglo-American strategy says the euro must die so the dollar can live. And the pound will also live in that scenario. So any expert you see from Britain, you can discount them because they are torpedoes, right? They're being used against the euro. Now, the euro, of course, is a flawed creation, but it comes out of a real need. There was an organic necessity for something like the euro, which is that the European community, right, the European coal and steel, going back to the 50s and 60s, had become so integrated that you had commodities crossing, you know, the classic was the Belgian-German border. You had commodities that would cross the Belgian-German border 10 or 20 times during the process of production, if it was a car, say. And how did you handle that in terms of currency fluctuations, right? The Belgian franc and the German mark. How could you do that? That was unacceptable. That added in an element of risk that was multiplied many, many times over. So what you see is, as soon as the Bretton Woods system collapsed, and this is the great turning point in all our lives, August 15th, 1971, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, it collapsed under attack by the British, not the French, but the British, as I write in Surviving the Cataclysm. After that point, you've got this chaos of floating rates. So the Europeans responded to that immediately with the so-called snake, which was that there would be a fixed parity system maintained among the main European currencies, above all Belgian franc, French franc, German mark, Dutch, Denmark, a couple of others, right? Essentially the Bundesbank and the cooperating currencies. And that then became the snake in the tunnel, and there were attempts to associate Italy to that, which, you know, failed and succeeded. The French were sometimes under attack, and so on and so forth. In other words, there's a real need to remove currency risk after the fall of the Bretton Woods system. And the problem with it, the whole thing, was they got the European rate mechanism in place by the early 90s, and then that was smashed by Soros, acting as an agent of the New York Federal Reserve, which is what he often is. So the Europeans were left with this chaotic floating rate situation, which was becoming unsustainable. So they then moved to the euro. Now, of course, by the time they moved to the euro, we are 10 years deep into the post-Soviet era, and we have neoliberal ideology everywhere, so that the euro is done under very bad auspices, under neoliberal auspices, right? So there's a deflationary problem. There are all kinds of problems with the euro. But anyway, this is now reality. So now we are where we are. So what you've got to do is not go back and say this is flawed by original sin and therefore we have to sweep it away because it's illegal. There's a whole school of crackpot or legal crank German professors who will tell you all this stuff. They can prove to you that the euro is illegal and blah, blah, blah. But then what do you do with that? How do you respond to a world economic depression where you have the euro? I would say the following. The euro should now be compared to a convoy. You're in the North Atlantic and you're surrounded by Nazi wolf packs, except the wolf packs today are the hedge funds and the zombie banks. Any currency that drops out of the euro will be destroyed by speculation. And the reason for this is you can't go home again. You can't go back to the German mark. You can forget it. The drachma even more so. Any of these other currencies, you can forget them. And the reason is that in 1998-99, when the euro started, we didn't have derivatives in the way that we have now. Remember, derivatives were illegal from 1936 to 1982 in the United States under the Commodity Exchange Act. They were then legalized by Reagan, further legalized by Wendy Graham, and then finally legalized completely and deregulated by Clinton, Phil Graham, Rubin, Summers, in 2000, right? It was one of the last worst things that Clinton did was the complete deregulation of derivatives. So derivatives now mean that there are thermonuclear weapons that can be used against currencies, and woe to the currency that is caught flat-footed out alone. So remember, in the convoy system, any ship that dropped out of the convoy was doomed. And that would be the case today. Anybody dropping out of the euro is doomed, and there are two ways they're going to be doomed. If it's the Greeks, let's suppose the Greeks take the advice of these crackpot professors and say, oh, we're going back to the drachma. At that point, the drachma will come under speculative attack, a la Bess, as they say. In other words, a bear attack on the euro, on the drachma, to drive it down into the center of the earth. In other words, the drachma will come out of it having negative value, right? The old Rasputnik. The drachma will have negative value because you'll have to pay the garbage men to come and take it away. That means hyperinflation. That means a collapse of the standard of living much worse than what we've seen so far, and ultimately genocide for the Greeks. Greece becomes a failed state with a drachma which the speculators have just completely destroyed. Civil war, whatever you want. Now, let's take the other example, which is the German case, right? Let's suppose they imagine, and it's only the petty bourgeoisie that thinks this, right? The bankers and the industrialists, and Germany actually has some industrialists, they don't believe this. They want to hang on to the euro, I think with good reason. But the professors say, let's go back to the D-mark, right? We want to go home again. We want to turn the clock back and go back to the happy time. You can't, again, because of the derivatives, and it would mean the following. If you had a D-mark, at that point, the speculators would attack it by driving it up. They would drive it up into intergalactic space. The mark would go up to, unheard of rates, you know, maybe $10 to buy one mark. I don't know what it would be, but it would be rough. And at that point, Germany lives on exports, right? It's along with Japan, one of the most export dependent in the world. At that point, those exports would end because it would be priced out of the world market. At that point, Germany would go into a deflationary crash with a complete destruction of the economy. And again, would end up looking quite similar to Greece. So that is what you're going to get if you have this illusion that you can turn the clock back and turn away from the euro. Now, what Tsipras has done, and the reason I think he is a valid leader, and most of the criticisms about him, a lot of the criticisms come from the KKE, the Greek Communist Party, and those guys are bankrupt in the extreme, right? They are dogmatic and rigid, and they have really no idea what's going on in the world around them. But his starting point is, stay in the euro to avoid these problems, but have a debt moratorium in the euro. Why should you be forced out of the euro? Who's going to force you out? There's no mechanism in the Treaty of Rome or Maastricht or the Lisbon Treaty or whatever it is. There's no way to kick somebody out of the euro. There's every reason to say stay in the euro. So if you're being pushed, and those are his 5 points, right? I didn't go through the 5 points. Let me just parenthesis and go through them now. The 5 points that Tsipras campaigned on: no austerity, right? So roll back austerity, no wage austerity, no pension austerity, rehire the fired government workers, no to the IMF, no to the memorandum, no to the troika. Second one is stop the anti-worker, anti-union measures, the kind of stuff we see with Walker in Wisconsin or Ron Paul and Rand Paul and their nationwide union-busting plan. The third one are measures for social justice and democracy. These are sort of internal Greek institutional issues. The fourth is to prosecute and jail bankers that have committed felonies. And the fifth is the debt moratorium, that if the debt is considered onerous and the Greeks will decide, then those will be canceled. I would recommend that they make that into a cancellation of all debt that contains derivatives in any form. So the debt moratorium.
Let me throw an example at you, and you comment on it because you certainly know about this. Back in 2000, Argentina was in great trouble, and they basically told the creditors to take a hike.
I was just going to mention them. That was my next point.
Well, they told them to take a hike. Most of them finally succumbed. Some didn't. They waited a number of years, and in the end, they finally surrendered and got less than they would have gotten in the first place. And Argentina went through a couple of very, very tough years. And then they came back, and for 2 or 3 years, they were South America's strongest growing economy. Why can't Greece do the same thing Argentina did?
Yeah, that's exactly what they should do. If a lot of this debt simply can't be paid, so you say, we're having a debt moratorium. We're following not just Argentina, but Mexico, Brazil, Costa Rica. The list is about 25 to 30 countries that have done it. Notice Iceland did not do it, and they have paid a terrible price. The Iceland example is a red herring pulled out by, I think, the Wall Street Journal. The standard of living in Iceland has been just about cut in half because their currency has been devaluated by half, and they've therefore those wages have gone down. So Iceland actually needed a debt moratorium that they didn't declare. And there's a whole story about that, of which the protagonists are me and Assange on the two sides of the issue. But going back to Greece, what Tsipras says is, we're going to stay in the euro. How can you say Greece is not a part of Europe? And this is insane. Greece has been the center of Europe for 3,000 years. Credit default swaps have been around since, 1994, 1995. So you can't build Europe on credit default swaps. You got to build it on the historical nature of the peoples that are a part of this. Now, what he's also done, though, is to say, we stay in the euro and we fight. And he took two important trips during the election campaign. One to Paris to talk to Mélenchon. Now, Mélenchon is the left bloc. This was about 12%, I think, in the presidential election. And the program there was, how do you get control of the European Central Bank? Because that's the issue. Don't drop out of the convoy and get destroyed by the wolf packs of hedge funds, which would be the fate of Greece. Stay in the convoy and fight for control of the convoy. So he went to Mélenchon, and they had a programmatic discussion about this, and the thing that came to force the European Central Bank to do things that it's not doing, among other things, to fund an infrastructure program. And this is actually how you get out of the crisis. Then he went on to Germany, where we have Die Linke. This is the left bloc of Germany, right? And this is Oskar Lafontaine and this guy Gysi, left over from the DDR. And there you can actually see it. There's a six-point program of a European united front between Syriza of Greece and Die Linke of Germany. Now, they needed, you know, he needed to go to other countries, and I think he will. But there you see the idea. That's the other key thing. You've got to organize in all of Europe. Anybody who says, I'm sitting here in Germany and I'm not going to reach out to the Spanish or the Italian, that's just insane. That's like sitting in New York and saying, well, you know, I don't care what happens in California or Texas or whatever it is. It's just chauvinism gone wild, right? Blindness that knows no bounds. So what you need is a European-wide front that puts forward what? A program of what the European Central Bank ought to do. And I would sum it up in these words. You force the European Central Bank, right? You probably have to get rid of this guy Draghi, although, you know, these hacks can be made to do anything if you've got enough muscle behind it. Start issuing tranches of 1 trillion euros each. Let's call it a terra tranche, trillion euros, and put that into European infrastructure. Rebuild the entire highway system. Rebuild the entire rail system based on fast rail. Rebuild the entire energy grid based on the most modern forms of energy generation. Start building canals, water systems. And another one, which in Europe is extremely important, is public housing. Attractive, high-quality, middle-class public housing done with the European Central Bank providing the funding. So this is off budget. Notice this is not the budget of the national states. It's not the budget of the European Commission either. It's the European Central Bank using the inherent power of credit creation for job creation and infrastructure building. This could create, my estimate, 40 million new productive jobs at union wages in Germany, and you need it. The people say, oh, the German economy, they're so strong, they're having a boom. The unemployed in Germany right now are about 10 million, and they're hidden by this guy Gerhard Schröder, right, this right-wing social democrat, came in, and he got a plan from the head of Volkswagen called, the guy's name was Hartz, so it's called Hartz, right, not Hartz Mountain and not the bird seed, but that's what you get to live on is Hartz, right, that's why they call it Hartz, you get bird seed to live on. So these people are vegetating at, you know, 600, 700 euros per month. They're just sort of kept going so they don't go out and start a riot, which otherwise they would do. But think of it. Germany is supposedly the powerhouse of Europe, and they've got 10 million unemployed, right, when you add it all in. So 40 million may even be a lowball estimate. You think you can do that with the drachma? You can't. You're going to do it with the Luxembourg franc? You forget it. The peseta? It's ridiculous. These are jokes. In a world dominated by China, India, Brazil, United States, Russia, these European countries, they are obsolete in the sense of their financial apparatus is simply inadequate for what's necessary. But there's no reason to break up Europe. You know, Steve, in the Panic of 1837, right, due to the crackpot policies of Andrew Jackson, right, the tool of London and the tool of Martin Van Buren, you had a lot of U.S. states went bankrupt, right? I think at that point there were 27 states and 8 to 10 of them went bankrupt. Nobody thought that a state should leave the United States because it's bankrupt. What the hell is that? What kind of a political construct is Europe if you're gonna be kicked out because you're bankrupt? So in other words, insolvency means you're no longer a European? That's ridiculous. It's just absolutely nonsense. So stay in the euro and fight to reform it from within, because your chances of fighting to reform it from within are better than they would be if you drop out of the convoy, because then you're doomed. Then you can forget everything. Then you go into a total crisis, which will be brought about by Goldman Sachs and the rest of them destroying your currency using these credit default swaps. The ability of Greece to ban credit default swaps is approaching zero. The ability of the European Union to ban credit default swaps, I think, is rather formidable, especially if they would say, London, you either get rid of those credit default swaps or you're out of the picture.
I got to cut in, Webster. This must be the fastest hour in radio. My God. I mean, we could spend the rest of the afternoon talking about this stuff. But the music
I hope
says,
people will look at Tarpley.net. Tarpley.net.
Oh, Tarpley.net. Absolutely. Webster's website. Or just Google Webster Tarpley. You'll find your videos and so on. Webster, I thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
I got you into this on short notice. I appreciate your providing a lot of insights.
Glad
to
it worked out.
And I'll just remind my listeners, as I always do, every Thursday we're on 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Absolutely make it a regular habit. We'll be back next Thursday.